This is Remote Ruby.
Have you any remote ideas to the meaning of the word?
Welcome to Remote Ruby. Today we are joined by DHH, and we are here to talk about all things Rails, especially right now, Rails 7 and the end of the Webpacker era. I'm just going to call it that. So, David, thanks for joining us.
Sure, absolutely.
Chris, Andrew, anything we want to kick off with?
I was thinking back, like last time we talked was January or something of this year. So that was shortly after, because Hotwire dropped like the 23rd of December or something like that. So it was an exciting Christmas with new Hotwire and Ruby and whatnot. So there's been a lot that has changed since then. Just lots of not high level concepts so much as like all the little tweaks and everything of getting sprockets updated to deal with digested assets and whatnot. So I thought we can go over maybe what's new. And I mean, this is a big release for Rails, but what's cool is kind of like all the stuff has been battle tested for the last year already. So I thought maybe you'd talk about what is Hotwire for anybody that's not familiar and what's new in Rails.
I think what's most exciting to me about this release is that all the pieces are coming together at the same time. This is literally the complete vision of what I sort of always hoped Rails would be. What it was in periods, particularly in the early days, where in full stack literally just meant, hey, you put HTML and you have a CSS file, and there wasn't a whole lot of JavaScript. And then we entered into a different era where modern applications required large amounts of JavaScript and tried a lot of different ways to deal with that, incorporate that, make it smooth, make the development experience feel like it was a cohesive approach. And I mean, I think it's fair to say that some of those attempts were more successful than others. And that wasn't so much, I think, necessarily because we weren't trying hard enough. I think it was just as much because the pieces didn't come together at the same time. Like the advances in JavaScript exploded, but required all this machinery to make it work. And then all of these pieces slowly started falling into place. HTTP2. Oh, now you actually don't need to bundle. It's not a huge speed advantage. In some cases, it's a speed disadvantage because you end up expiring your assets much more frequently. Boom, that's in place. ESM, the fact that JavaScript and browsers really got as good as it is, that you can ship JavaScript straight to the browser and it's really nice JavaScript. It doesn't need processing. And then import maps. And import maps is the biggest thing that changed from last year to now. When I first saw import maps, this is the key. This is the final key to the puzzle that unlocks the whole thing. Because if you don't have import maps, you can't build anything advanced in JavaScript. It just doesn't work. Because whenever you have to update any files, you would have to go back and name all those references. It just didn't work. Import map was the unlocking technology that simply made the whole thing come true. And by the whole thing, I mainly mean, let's get Node the hell out of here. It's funny because I had a period of my time developing where I really disliked Node and I thought it was really just, And then I spent a lot of time working with it because I wanted to get Webpacker working. I wanted to do things at Basecamp and with Hey, where we used modern JavaScript, we weren't going to live in the past. And I just sort of gritted my teeth and through trials and tribulations arrived at a place where I'm like, okay, I kind of get this now. But then I'd go away for like a month and I'd come back and I was like, holy shit, what was it again? Oh, geez, I got to start all over. And it was actually at that moment, I think, I'm trying to remember exactly when it was, but I had a moment when I was trying to get some JavaScript from Basecamp into Hey, and I just couldn't do it. There was something in the Webpack configurations that wasn't meshing. And I was just like, this can't be true. Fucking wrote Webpacker. If I can't figure it out, who can figure it out? Who has a chance at this if you're not immersed in it all day, every day? I totally get that. If you're in it all day, every day, you figure it out and you stick with your routine and you can go with it and it's not a big deal. But you know what? If we're trying to create a full stack framework, you're not going to be in the JavaScript part all day, every day. You're going to be in all the other parts of it. And that frustration really just saw its salvation in import maps, because getting that final piece together I was like, we can go all the way back. We can turn back the time to 2005 when JavaScript was just something you wrote in your editor and then the browser executed it. And all of the hardship of making the pieces work and the pipelines and the build steps and all that stuff would just disappear. But what was interesting was at the beginning of this year, that was speculative, very speculative. Import maps, first of all, is a quite new, I was about to say standard. I think that's fair. I mean, it's a standard, whether it's broadly adopted yet everywhere. It was a new standard. It hadn't even properly shipped. It was still in the development version of Chrome. I think Chrome shipped it for reals this summer. Is that right? Something around those lines. And still hasn't shipped as a native feature in Firefox or Safari, but there was an excellent shim. And that was the other part that really sort of made this possible. Because one thing is like, okay, Chrome has a nice feature. Yeah, that's great. Can't use that. Unless you're willing to say like, oh, well, only 85% of my users really can use my thing. It's not going to work. The gap was too big. But then here's the shim. And I really got involved with that with Guy Bedford, who created the shim, which is an excellent JavaScript programmer who knew all the inwards of this and really started using it in anger. Because the shim, I think, had been used in some ways, but I don't know if there were a lot of apps that were like the size of hay trying to use this. And we really tickled it through and brought it all the way from sort of early stage proof of concept being used in a little bit to, no, this is so good that we can make it the default in Rails 7. I was quite speculative. And I'd got to say, like, we hit some snags along the way where I was like, shit, I bet on the wrong horse. It's not going to work. We're going to have to turn the ship around and we're going to have to do something else. And for me, the big moment was when I got Hey running on Import Maps. And I was like, Hey is a major app. There's a lot in it. If you can build a Hey with this, you can build 99% of everything else. And it was funny in the way that the path unfolded, where I was so excited at the beginning of the year, but I knew we hadn't validated this. And then we got closer and my confidence levels just kept going up. I was like, oh man, I wish we could do this. I wish we could just get rid of Webpack. Not because there's something necessarily wrong with Webpack. It's trying to solve a difficult problem and it's evolved over many years. And I'm deeply grateful to the fact that it exists. It did exist and it provided a transition from, hey, now we can do a lot more cool stuff with JavaScript. You just got to go through this maze to make it all work, but at least you can, to the point where we now are like, all right, so long and thanks for all the fish. It was great. And there's technologies like that. You can look back and like, I don't want to work with that again if I can help it, but I'm also internally grateful that it existed for the time that it did. And excited about that. But as we go through the year, the confidence level is increasing. I also just become more bullish on the whole thing that, like, you know what? Rails can be opinionated. I was going to say it's literally written into the Constitution. It's written into the doctrine. That is one of the core pillars of what Rails is, why Rails is different. There are all these other options. You can go out there and pick and choose and put your own little thing together. But what we have now with the awesome backend framework we have in Rails that's continued to just evolve. I mean, it's funny, as a quick aside, I follow This Week in Rails, which is the newsletter that the team has been getting. Every week I'm like, oh, wow. Oh, that's so cool. I had no idea that all these things are going in. And every week you see like, oh, 40 major new things just shipped this week. And I'm like, oh, wow, amazing. Anyway, so we have that solid base. And then I was looking at how far we'd come with Hotwire. And then thinking, do you know what? Are we going to do this? Are we going to double down here and just go like, no, this is the path, a default path. I mean, there's another good discussion afterwards about what that means, but at least for the default, Rails is going to be opinionated about that. It's going to be full stack, unapologetically full stack, all the way from Active Record, the databases, the queues, to Hotwire on the front end, which is far more ambitious in what it tries to do than Turbolinks ever was, than Rails UJS ever was. Those two technologies, as good as they were, took you, I don't know, 20, 30, 40% of the way. Hotwire, for a huge number of applications, will literally take you the whole way. So it's funny to think back over this year. And, oh, I remember it, I don't know, in February thinking like, you know what? Hotwire is good. We're using Hotwire here. This is good. But can it be a Rails default? Is that pushing it too far? Are we going too far with this? To getting to the point of like, no, of course it should be. And then now it's out and you're like, yeah, I wouldn't want it any other way. It doesn't even seem risky now, which is just interesting, like how you can go from like, oh, I perceive this as like, I don't know how the community is going to feel about it. Maybe we're going to have to push through. And part of this is, of course, I think back of all the major Rails things. Like when we did REST, people were like, ah! When I introduced pluralization, people were like, ah! Like there's all these points in Rails history where you go like, that was really controversial at the time. You push through and a year later, everyone goes like, yeah, duh, of course we're pluralizing. Yeah, duh, of course we're doing all these things. And I thought that was going to happen here. And maybe it is, and I'm just not listening in the right corners, but it seems like the general reaction is far more positive, far sooner in the process than many of these other big changes for Rails were at the time, which is really just encouraging. And I think the proof is just in the pudding. It's good. And that was the other thing you mentioned, Chris, that so Hotwire goes into Rails, not like the day after it was released. Hotwire had time to build a following and to convert people on its own merits when they actually had to do the work of integrating it. And I'm just hearing it from so many corners now. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. We dumped our React setup. It just wasn't working. We put in Hotwire. Voila. It's really nice. And you hear that enough where people like, not because I went out to evangelize to them, but just on their own, they're like, oh, gave it a try, picked it up, and just like, this is just better. We're going to do it. So, that ends up with where we are right now with Rails 7, incredibly opinionated, far more ambitious than it ever was in terms of like how much of the pie does it try to solve, and seeing that culminate then in the video I recorded. So I did a new video for the new Rails site. It's just under 30 minutes. And you look at what it does now and you compare it to the earlier video. Some of them were a little shorter, but like how much you get, how close this is like to a real system. And I wanted to emphasize that point by deploying it and showing like all these pieces. Like you're literally going from there's nothing to, hey, here's a blog. It has comments. It does live updating. It has what you see is what you get editing. It has cloud storage of files. And boom, now it runs on a cloud setup in freaking 30 minutes. And I'm not even cheating in terms of the components that go into it. So
and another 30 minutes later, you could have it running on iOS and Android and Electron too, which is like the whole other thing that hasn't been talked about enough yet. I remember the goal of TurboLinx eventually was to be able to support building iOS and Android apps, and never quite got to where it needed to be, but it's here now. And in an hour, you could build, deploy your app to Heroku and the Apple approval process and stuff, regardless. You can at least have it running on your demo, your simulators and stuff. And that is awesome. So it's even more full stack than just the web full stack, I think.
That's what's so wild about what this gives. And we're with this whole thing of the one person framework. Like I can literally imagine, and I'm always trying to do this, I'm imagining myself starting over from scratch. It's just me. And maybe it's Jason as well. Like we're just the two of us. We're starting over from scratch and like, we want to build a real thing, a real competitive thing. You could do that. You could literally be the same person who builds the whole thing and does the iOS app and does the Android app. Now, it does get harder. And the path we've taken with Turbo and Hotwire in general there is that we're not trying to kind of cheat our way through. Like, hey, here's a way that like could just kind of work for this little toy thing. No. This is literally what we used to run Hey. Which, Hey, is predominantly an iOS email app. That's the usage numbers we get back. So the most important platform for Hey is actually not even the web. It is iOS. And it's built with these technologies and they just all come up through the same chain. I'm glad you brought it up because when I talk about this, I talk about the full vision being there. And I mostly talk about it from a website because that's where I mostly come at things. We have developers at Basecamp who do the native stuff. But the vision really is so broad as to be computing. If you look at, hey, we got the Electron apps distributed on the Mac, on Windows, on Linux. We got the Android app. We have a dedicated iOS app that's split into both an iPhone part of it and an iPad part of it. You count up all those platforms and you go, what other technology could you use to be on, what is that, 6-7 platforms in this way with that small of a team? I don't know of any. I haven't seen anything in the wild that allows you to go that broadly with that small of a team. So that's super exciting. It's interesting to see. It will be interesting to see how much adoption that gets. Like on the Turbolink side, we didn't have that much adoption on the native side. Like we put it all out there, but I didn't hear back that much. And part of it is because it is more difficult. Like it's a real iOS app. So you got to do all the things and so on and so forth. So the barriers to entry are a little higher. I'm curious to see if we'll get more update on it, but I don't care. We're putting it out there because I want to have all the cards on the table. That there's no secret sauce whatsoever at Basecamp about how we build all the things we build. It's all out there, and anyone who wants to use it, they can follow it. And there's just such a satisfaction of knowing that, that I'm really proud of. And also that all those pieces that we've spent years and years getting to, Turbolinks traces its origin back to 2012 when the first version of Turbolinks came out. Stimulus now goes back to, I think, was it 16 or something like that? Like it's quite a bit old now too. So all of these things that we're just cooking, just getting ready, boom. Like all the clocks are going off at the same time. Yep, ready, 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 ready. Let's launch.
Yeah, and it's so good timing for all of that and the less need for Node by doing import maps or if you want ES build or roll up or whatever. But like to have those happen at the same time is pretty awesome.
I'm curious because I know with Hey, you're able to go full like import map and you're working on Basecamp 4. Do you see yourself being able to move to import maps only for Basecamp 4 eventually? Or is there like ES build involved? What's that looking like?
Yeah. So the funny thing is that we haven't actually launched the Hey version on import maps yet. It's just about there. I really wanted to get it out before Rails 7 because it'd just be nice to say. We had a few things actually on the native adapters that had to change because of how import map is set up, but been running it internally as a version for months. It's great. Basecamp is in a little bit different situation. First of all, because Basecamp 4 is a continuation of Basecamp 3. Up until Basecamp 4, we rewrote. So Basecamp 1 is a completely separate code base from Basecamp 2, is a completely separate code base from Basecamp 3. And then for Basecamp 4, for the first time, we were like, oh, actually, this could do it. The things we want to do for 4 does not require a full rewrite. So Basecamp 3's code base traces back to 2012, I think, actually. That is kind of a long time. And it does have some marks of that in its evolution. It has, for example, the split before and after stimulus. Stimulus grew out of me one Christmas looking at the JavaScript we had at Basecamp going like, we're writing like 4 different styles here. There's got to be a way where we can come up with a framework that combines the best of those different dialects, if you will, into one way so that we all just write it the same way. So it has old JavaScript code. It has jQuery in it. Plenty of it even. Full like early 2010 style jQuery and the works. And then it has a substantial amount of code that was written with stimulus and the new Go. So going from that to import maps is a substantial jump. Now, you don't necessarily need to do the jump. That's what we did with this division. We said like, hey, we want to use stimulus going forward. We're not going to rewrite all the code. We're just going to start writing all the new controllers in, or all the new code as controllers in stimulus. So there's like this line and we have both things. So we ship sprockets based JavaScript of the old guard, not modules, not anything. Things that are just including jQuery, this and that, and the other things. That's one file, a piece of JavaScript that's included. Next file is modern JavaScript in the sense of we were using stimulus and all that stuff. That's being built with ES build. So we used to run Webpacker for that. In fact, Webpacker was created such that Basecamp 3 could use the modern style of JavaScript and we could write the stimulus code in it and so forth. And now, once I started working on the new stuff, the jump from Webpacker to ES build is minimal. I did it in literally, I think, 2 hours. Converted the whole Webpacker setup for Basecamp to use ES build with the new JS bundling Rails approach, which in itself was just such a fascinating thing that like there was actually no technology. We talked about with import maps, all sorts of things had to happen. HTTP 2 had to happen. The standard had to happen. Someone had to ship it. The shim had to be really good. The JS bundling dash Rails approach, we could have done that in 15. Literally somehow, I don't know why, but this idea that, hey, you have a JavaScript toolchain that produces an output file that Sprockets then picks up and digests and uses. I don't know why the hell I didn't think about it. I don't know why the hell anyone else didn't think about it and said, hey, do you know, actually, you don't need all the shit. You could just go straight to an output file that then feeds into Sprockets. Somehow, I had locked it in my brain that if we went down this path, we needed a parallel universe where everything was just being done by itself. And that was why Webpack actually had quite a lot of moving parts. You look at the moving parts for JS bundling Rails and you go like, where are they? Where are the moving parts? There are literally no moving parts. We went, hey, use ES Build or Rollup or Webpack or whatever. If you can produce an output file that goes to app assets builds application.js, boom, you're hooked in. All the rest of the machinery is just going to work. So you look at that gem and you go like, wow, it's so thin. It's basically just an installer that sets up some default commands for like, oh, ES Build, here's how to put your stuff and so on. So that's where Basecamp is now. It uses ES Build with the JS bundling approach. I'd like to get to import maps, but there are few things to sort of consider in that transition. One is that when you use import maps, you're using the browser to do all the JavaScript. There's no transpilation, which means you have to actually think that the browsers support the features you need. So Stimulus 3, for example, with public fields for declaring things, that was not supported until Safari 14.1. Now, that's a wildly distributed version and it's fine, but there could be, for example, on Basecamp, we have a broader responsibility to support more clients for longer because people invite their clients into it versus, hey, we can be quite aggressive. Hey, if you're paying $100 a year for email, you can probably afford a recent phone that has a modern operating system on it. Versus with Basecamp, we have to be a little more like conservative. It wasn't actually until this year we dropped IE 11 for Basecamp. So we'll see where that goes. But right now I'm actually in some ways almost happy because on the one hand, we have Basecamp 3 that really gets to flex the JS bundling dash Rails setup using the ES build. And import map can't replace all the things for all the people. Anyone who wants to do a full Rails app with React, for example, and like not just a Rails app that uses React, but a React app with Rails, you're going to want to use JSX probably, which means you do need the whole pipeline and you need all the stuff. And I want to make sure that I continue to flex it, at least at the base core of it, just that it stays solid. And then, hey, gets to do all the most modern, most ambitious, most cutting edge stuff, but also on a really wide platform. Like this isn't, hey, isn't some little niche app that like 20 people use, right? Like there's like tens of thousands of paying customers who will tell us if things don't feel good or faster or whatever. So that was the other thing that was so interesting to happen this year was that like not only did the import map approach become viable, and that took some time and took some leaps of faith, the other path became viable too. That we managed to somehow both make it way nicer to work with a node setup backend for your front end in Rails and give you an amazing path that doesn't even require node, which is, I mean, I'm quite proud of that because if we had just doubled down and got import map, that's what it is. If you want to use JSX, if you want to do related, but not in a good way, because it's just, it's too exclusionary. It would run into the other tenet of the Rails doctrine, which is we're trying to push up a large tent here. Rails should be a framework that you can use if you want to use Vue or if you want to use React or if you want to use any of these other things. We can still come together and work on Active Record together and the controllers and all that other stuff. But what's clear to me in all of this was that Webpacker was always a transition point. It was never the final destination. And I knew it going in. This is a compromise. I'm not thrilled with this compromise, but at this moment in time, it's the best compromise we can have. And now we have a way better compromise. The compromise being, if you aren't buying into a huge single page application approach to building your thing, you get to wave all of that complexity goodbye. And there's so many people who start out with Rails, like, hey, I just want to learn Rails. I want to just want to get going. And like then they hit a Webpack config issue and they just go like, okay, web development is too hard. Like maybe I should just do something else. And that's just, it's really shitty. And I feel a little bad about that in the art of the possible here we went through with the Webpacker era, that like that undoubtedly ended up turning some people off. And now we're back to a version of Rails where someone can install it, start using it, and they're not building a toy thing that then has to be thrown away so they can learn the quote unquote real thing. No, no, no. This thing will take you all the way to an app like, hey, it's a really great path that is a much shallower learning curve. And hopefully we can get the best of both worlds. We can get the people who really want to do the node setup. They'll have a much better story, much better integration, much more like quote unquote normal. They'll just be like, hey, I'm really good with the JavaScript ecosystem. Plop. You go into a Rails app. Hey, it's just the same thing. This is just a Node app that lives inside a Rails app. And it's totally normal. And we don't try to pave over it or abstract it or build other things on top as Webpack did. And then at the same time, there's also the peaceful coexistence of people who just go like, Node what?
Yeah.
A few people in the chat are asking about Strata. So I know on the website it says coming 2022, but can you say anything about that?
Yeah, it's funny. It says coming 2022 because someone emailed me like 4 days ago saying like, hey, it's almost the end of 2021. Like, where's Strata? And I was like, oh yeah, we should update that. Coming 2022. I regret a little bit that we went out to advertise that piece because for some people it meant like Hotwire isn't ready, which it is. The Strata piece is like the last sprinkle on top to make the integration between a web app and a native app feel better, but you don't need it. It's a nice add-on on top for communication back and forth such that you can have more of your app on the web side of things. Percent stuff such that it feels more native. It's level up stuff. And I should have been a little more explicit about that because it seems like it's a trinity that like, hey, you have Turbo and then you have Stimulus and then you have Strata and they're all like equal legs and they're not. Turbo is, let's say, 75%. Then Stimulus is 20% and then Strata is the last 5. But we are working on it. We just bulked up our native teams substantially. We have the biggest native teams we've ever had now at Basecamp because we've gone all in on this idea that we're going to develop Hey and Basecamp at the same time. So we are going to have a ton more capacity to be able to do this properly in 2022. And I'm really looking forward to that because that's the other thing of it. Strata is in some ways like the native camp telling the web, hey, this is what we need, instead of the other way around. And that needs to be informed by people who are really good at building native apps. And that's not me. So part of that is to get that new capacity at Basecamp to work on this and just get it out there. That was the other thing. I mean, it's sort of like we've done the first 90%. So, I mean, the joke is that now there's 90% left. But that 90% left is mostly communication, wrapping it up, having proper documentation and so on. I think one of the things that made Hotwire do well was that it shipped with really good docs. Not perfect docs, but good docs. You could go from like, hey, someone sent you a link to hotwire.dev. And you're like, all right, I can figure this out. And you could actually do stuff. I want to make sure that Strata feels like it's at the same level.
Yeah, I remember. How do we convert our JavaScript to work with Turbolinks? That was a thing that was just like, it's hard to do that for every third party JavaScript and everything. Those have also improved over the years. And a lot has changed. And I wanted to go back real quick because the CSS and JS bundling, I think the way that turned out was so clean and so simple. And like, yes, there is a requirement in the gem spec of like Rails 6 and higher, but you can just apply this to like any rake enhancement in earlier versions if you want, and like just use that. And just set it up manually for the most part. And it just reminded me of the like Unix command line approach where we take the output of one command, pipe it into the next one. And that's really how it works. Tailwind to the asset pipeline and sprockets, voila, just let them do what they're best at. And I think that is a really good like realization because we can go down the whole path of Webpacker and have this complicated setup. But for this, it just made so much sense. It's like a great moment of clarity when I saw that. I was like, wow. You go through those times of building something and you're like, we need to do more complex stuff. And then eventually you realize we don't need those things and we can make it back in the simple version. I feel like that's kind of been a trend that I've noticed in the Turbo side of Hotwire, going from saying, we've got Rails UJS and we've got these remote as true links and all of these things, and like, using the method delete for example, let's just not do that. And let's use the button twos and just make a form and make that do the delete like the web was built for. I think that's kind of been a trend I've noticed in the past year of like, hold on, let's just go back and use the tools that we have had forever. And we'll just use them in a simple way. I was just kind of curious what your thoughts on all that, because it's just, you know, I think making it easier all around and wrapping up sort of the missing pieces of Turbolinks that way is, it's a great way to do it.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is the hardest thing to do are the simple things that in retrospect seem like, duh, of course we should have done it like that. But sometimes you have to go through a very convoluted path to be able to end up with a simple, clear way of doing it. And with Webpacker, part of my motivation was being overly ambitious, that somehow I could hide all the node complexity under a layer of Ruby such that someone could use it in a way where they did not need to understand it. It was an attempt at compressing complexity, but there was too much leakage. It was just, we couldn't do it. It was a failed attempt at compressing complexity, to be perfectly blunt. Not that people didn't ship good apps with it. They did. It was just, it didn't arrive at the simplicity of it. There was too often where it turned into a leaky abstraction in the worst possible way. Where like, we get you going, everything is fine. And then all of a sudden it's not fine. And you need to understand every last nut and bolt. Otherwise you can't put it back together. And that's just not a great path, which is why the import map way of doing it is just such a cleaner way. And that required the new thinking. And then on the other hand, just going like, do you know what? This is an area of complexity we cannot compress. Let's just give up, right? I'm trying to gzip a PNG here. It's just not going to yield that much. So let's give up and embrace the fact that for the experts who are able to both live in the node world and in the Ruby world at the same time, let them. And let them be fully exposed to the complexity, the inherent complexities of it. I thought that more of it was incidental. That it was incidental complexity is the kind that compresses very well, and inherent complexity is the kind that compresses very poorly. And I got the reading wrong. Not that I necessarily know. Well, actually, I was going to say, couldn't have done it differently. You could have. We could have the JS bundling dash Rails approach, the command line, the Unix style approach, could have done that in 16. And with hindsight, that would have definitely been a lot nicer to do. But here we are. And I think that's the other part of it is don't be vetted and wedded to your past decisions. I wrote the first version of Webpacker and I am the first to cheer that it is no longer necessary. And I'll preview one more exciting bit here is that this approach of the command line approach where we hand things off from building things in Node to apply the same thing to Tailwind. So Tailwind currently with Rails 7 as it looks right this very second, and it's about to change in about five more. But right this second, if you want the full version that does everything and you can tailor in all the ways, you need to go the full node path. I talked a lot to Adam about this, especially once they went into this JIT approach. It's like, are you really going to make anyone who wants to use Tailwind install all of Node? And it's like, the benefits are pretty big here, like of what we get out of the JIT compilation, and we could do a lot of other things. And then thankfully, they somehow arrived at a way of doing executables. Everything in one executable. We don't need all of Node installed. And you can hide it, all of it, in essentially just one command. We're going to go that way with Tailwind CSS-Rails, such that you can use the full Monty of Tailwind 3 with an import mapped Rails 7 app that does not require Node. And it's going to follow exactly the same pattern that you have this new executable that's platform specific, and we're going to distribute almost like Nokigiri that has pre-compiled binaries for the different platforms. We're going to do the same thing for Tailwind CSS Rails. It's going to bundle these platform specific binaries, and then it's going to produce a Tailwind CSS file that just is going to put into app assets builds, and it's all just going to work. The funny thing there, of course, is I wrote like essentially a Ruby version of Tailwind. I mean, not of the framework, but of the purger. And like, it's a fair bit of code. And I wrote it like 5 minutes ago almost. Like, it's not that old. I don't know even how much it's been used in anger. And I'm like, oh, this is so wonderful to be able to, I just deleted the code just before jumping on this call, actually. I was just like trying to ready up the first version of Tailwind CSS-Rails 2.0. Which will be a completely different version. It's kind of actually interesting. This is like, it's using the same GM name, but like there's nothing left on the inside. Like The compressor's gone, the percher's gone, the hooks into sprockets is gone. All that stuff is gone. And it's essentially now much more like CSS bundling dash Rails, except that it doesn't require the whole enchilada. So sometimes that's like, once you've seen a pattern, you've spotted a thing, you can't unsee it. And now you start seeing just like how that might apply in different areas of what you're working on. And that also just came at just such a great moment. Like we arrive at this at just the same time as the Tailwind crew is like, we need JIT, whatever. Okay. That means we kind of have to have a full node thing running. I go like, Adam, please don't. And they find a way to boil it down to an executable that we can use together with this new style Rails apps with no excuses. That's the other thing I liked about it. Like there were excuses for the Tailwind CSS Rails things where I wrote my own percher and it had, you can't tailor it. We got to keep the number of plugins at a minimum and all these other things. And now we get like the full thing. It's great.
That was one of the reasons why I went with Webpack in the first place. And then what's nice is the CSS bundling option for Tailwind and Bootstrap and everything else provides a pretty seamless, if you want to use Node, you can grab any of those frameworks and run with them very easily and follow, for the most part, the instructions on their website, which is kind of a handy thing instead of going and finding like, what's the Rails specific way we need to set things up? I think that's been a great improvement there. One of the questions in the chat on YouTube here was, what are your thoughts on componentizing views, like the view component gem that GitHub's been doing? Because I'm sure that there are quite a few different complex components in Hay and Basecamp that you have to kind of figure out, how do we make them testable and everything? And I think that was a lot of people's interest in view component. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
I'm going to start with the most diplomatic version, which is I love the large tent at Basecamp. And the large tent is a metaphor for myself, at least I use it as a metaphor for myself, for accepting that I don't have to like everything, that not everything we do in Rails. RSpec is perhaps the predominant example. RSpec is a very widely used testing framework that, and I mean this in the dearest possible way, I can't stand. I don't like RSpec. I don't like the syntax. I don't like anything about it. But I love, absolutely adore the fact that for some people, that's awesome. That's what they want to do. And we can coexist here. We can live in the same big tent and like, we're using the same active record and we're using the same this and we're using the same that. And you just tested with RSpec. And I go like, so good for you. I'm really happy, genuinely. And that is something I perhaps have developed more that I perhaps didn't quite have in 2004 when I launched Rails, this sort of openness to the idea that like, if I can just agree with you on like 80% of what we do, I mean, that's amazing. We can work together on 80% of what we share in common. And then the 20% can differ, and that's totally fine. View components to me, it's not that quite RSpec levels of, I don't gel with it, but it's not a path I want to write. I don't want to write my applications that way. Now, that is not to say that there aren't times where the view is complicated enough that it needs more structure than a helper can provide. My own heuristic here is, when I start having helpers that are interdependent, did you have to call multiple helpers that call each other? That's screaming for an object. And I just do a Ruby object and I keep the partials, and the Ruby object provides the massaging of usually the domain models because they fit together in certain ways that doesn't quite gel with how it needs to be presented in the HTML. So the presenters, as we call them, just are like adapters. Here's the domain model that has maybe five different underlying models. They need to interact in one specific way with a view, put a presenter around it, which is essentially a series of helpers that are interdependent and can rely on shared state and so on. And that's where I want to go with it. But what was so great about view components was, I don't know if you saw the PR. What did it take to support view components in Rails? I think the PR is literally one or two lines. Like it just allows you to, if you pass in an object that fits a certain doc type, it gets past the context for the view it's in, and it can do everything it needs to do. And I'm like, that's really great. I can smile about that without going like, that's how I want to build my apps. Because that's the other thing where you have to, if you want the big tent, and I very much want the big tent, there's huge benefits to having a large tent. The more you go like, well, we can only work together if we agree on 100% of everything. Yeah, then I can work together with like three stooges and a parrot. that's a very narrow definition of collaboration. If we have to agree on everything down to the most minute detail. Now, on the same hand, if we disagree on everything, it's also not going to work out. So you have to find some overlap. But for me, maybe that overlap is as low as 70%. I don't know where exactly where it is, but if we agree on 70% of the things and you go like, I like view components, I like RSpec, I like all these things. And then we can still go like, oh, great, let's collaborate on the other 70%. So that's kind of where I am on view components. The one thing I maybe didn't feel so good about the process was the initial naming and so on implied that this was coming to be like the new default in Rails that was going to go in. So maybe that ended up giving some, I don't know, wrong expectations for some people that like, oh, this is the new way we're going to do this. Because one of the privileges of creating a framework and still being involved with it is that I have a large influence on the defaults. That's why I am interested in still being part of this framework, is because I usually have like a quite clear vision in my head of where things to go. And to the largest extent, except if that's a really peculiar thing. And sometimes I do recognize that where like, okay, I'm just weird here and I won't try to push that weirdness on others. And in other cases, I'll go like, do you know what? Let's make the big tent, but like, I'm going to pave a path through it. That if you don't care, if you haven't made up your mind as to whether to use RSpec or Minitest, you're going to get Minitest. You're going to get what I would prefer to build up. I'm going to make it super duper easy for you to do something else. But if you don't have an opinion, you're going to go down this preordained path. And that set of defaults is influenced, and maybe controversially so, I'm not sure, but by what I like. And that's kind of just the setup of it. And this is also why I'm so happy about the Big Tent, because the more flexible the framework feels in ways where you're like, hey, if you disagree with me on like this thing, I can just do my own thing. And it doesn't feel like you're totally fighting it. The more room there actually is for the default paths to be even more opinionated, because not everyone is being forced into this straitjacket. They can just make their little substitutions and we can all be happy together. So view components, I think you should just try it. If you're hitting things in your app where you go like, my views feel shit. I don't know why. Maybe I want to test them more. Try it. Give it a go. And sometimes some things are going to just click with you and you're going to go like, that's great. And then you should use another time you give it a go and you're like, yeah, this is not quite what I want. And then at least you've learned. In fact, when it comes to components, sort of historically, I'm not the biggest fan of splitting things up. We don't use a bunch of like sub parts of the app as gems and all these other approaches that some people build Rails apps with. So I'm going to come down on this one side of it. I'm very much a holistic one person should be able to understand the whole app and work with it and not the subdivision. And I understand that there are moments where that perhaps breaks down either with frequent sort of different people swapping in and out of an app, or you have a very large organization, blah, blah, blah. All sorts of reasons why how I like to build apps will not be the right answer for everything. But I'd like to believe that it is a pretty good answer for some of the people, some of the times at least, which is one of the reasons why I always find the discussion about some of these things like, oh, funny. It's like, oh, Rails is going to go to shit like unless it changes the default. This like, okay, I mean, also we're here after 20 years doing pretty good. This is the path we followed the whole time. So like, I don't know. Maybe calamity is around the corner. And sometimes you can be delusional thinking just because things work well in the past that they're going to work well in the future. But also yesterday's weather.
I want to take a moment to thank our sponsor, honeybadger.io. One of the things that's really tricky about error monitoring is that when you get an error, it could have come from anywhere. It could have come from a background job or a user doing some weird thing and they have JavaScript turned off. You never know. And so you might get these stack traces, but you might not know how to debug them. And that is really a pain in the butt. So Honeybadger has a really cool feature called Breadcrumbs. And you can integrate their client-side and server-side libraries so that you can track what was going on when an error occurred. So for example, you have a front end. It has a button to go sign up. Your user clicks that and it makes a post request to your API. And your API has a failure response, and then your JavaScript has an error because, well, something went wrong on the back end. Well, what's really cool is that you're able to track all of that with Honeybadger and see the steps that actually happened in the browser and the server side. So you can go replicate those steps and try it yourself and actually replicate those errors and actually solve the bugs. And that is super cool because if you're just trying to look at the stack trace and you don't know what happened that led to that, it's really tough. So Honey Badger can really save you a bunch of time. I think that is one of my favorite features that they offer. And, you know, like we've said before, they have check-in monitoring. So if you've got cron jobs or like regular scheduled background jobs or anything like that, you can have those check in with Honey Badger and make sure that they're running. So you can feel confident that yes, your cron jobs actually are running. So that's it. I just wanted to give them a shout out. We love Honey Badger and they've been a long, long time supporter of everyone in the Rails community and they will continue to be. So check them out. They've got a generous free tier. There's really no reason not to use them.
As someone who does get to pick the defaults, I'm going to shoot my shot. What are your views on authentication being built into Rails?
Yeah, it's funny. It's actually a direct continuation of the past conversation. It's a component. And it's a component that's at such a high level that it sets certain expectations about how the app is going to work. Take device, for example. It's well above the limit that I would call infrastructure. It is far into how does the app feel and work in a way that influences how a user perceives the app. That to me is across the pond. That's outside of the scope of where I'd like to go. It's funny, when it comes to device, I wrote up a blog post, I think in 2005 or 2004, why I don't like components. And I usually point to it whenever there's a discussion about whether Rails should have authentication in it. Now, that is a assessment of like device style authentication that tries to do everything. There are answers below that line that do fit. Has secure password, for example, is an example of that. Do you know what? It would be good if we get everyone to bcrypt their passwords. There's some best practices here we can do on setting that up. And we should try to do that if they fall below the line at the infrastructure level where, hey, the user's not going to know how you're storing your passwords. That's below the line. And there are other things like that. I think, for example, we've done a lot of work with 2FA at Basecamp. And that is a little bit of an intricate work. And there's a fair amount of that that fall below the line that I could see. I don't know if it gets shoved in straight into Rails, but be like a... It's funny, I like this, like gaming consoles. And I remember in the 90s, you had like first party developers that were owned wholly by, or that was like Nintendo. They'd do first party games. And then they'd have second parties, which was essentially independent studios that were kind of fully owned or partly owned by the company. And then you had third parties that were their own thing. I think of some gems as second party gems. Kretis is a great example of a second party gem. Something for 2FA could be a great example for a second party gem, where it's like, there's some blessing here, but it's not straight in the framework right away. JBuilder is another great example of a second party gem.
All right, Jason. So DHH and Raphael both said no authentication in Rails.
That doesn't mean we can't improve that story and make it easier to get to. I think the fact that device has to do so much points to the fact that there are probably parts of device that could be below the line or it could be second party or something else. And then someone else builds on top of that to provide the whole, like, here's a flow to reset your password that sends out an email and all the other stuff.
I like the view of like first party, second party, third party. It helps like frame some things. And I think for me, like the reason I ask that question is because like the de facto is device like in the community, but often I sometimes feel like device is a little heavier than like most of my needs, but I also don't want to like read, write authentication logic.
Now, let me just make a short plea for that. You should. Do you know what? Authentication logic is, I know it's intimidating because people consider it to be high stakes. Oh, if I get this wrong, then like I have security issues. But it's not that hard either. And this is one of the reasons I've resisted doing this because we built like custom authentication schemes. Like, I don't know how many times I've built, what have I built? Like 20 major apps in my career or something like that. They all sort of had their own little authentication variations. It's not that difficult. And I actually, in some ways, what I really want to do, I want to make a video. Whenever someone goes to like, I almost want to make a video that's a gem. So you go like, install official Rails authentication and like it installs things. Boom, it just pops up a video. Let me show you how to build it. It's just what it does. Let me show you how to build it. It's not that complicated. I do feel like anyone who got a solid 20 minute, maybe 30 minute tutorial could build it with confidence. I think that's the main thing I see lacking, that there's a fair number of people who are like, they just don't have the confidence to do that part of the app. And I want to give them that confidence. I want to teach you to fish. I don't want to just give you a bunch of fish. I want to give you a better fishing rod I want to give you better whatever bait you put on it. All the things that make it such that like you're part of it and you're getting better. This was, I don't know if we want to get into this whole controversy, but this was my point about like, don't be the dog slamming at the keyboard, not knowing anything. Don't embrace that idea that like you're ignorant and you can't learn or something. It's just, to me, it's a really unappealing persona. I understand how you get there and I understand some of the benefits to like, hey, we all look shit up on the internet and we're all like normalizing that is healthy and good in a certain sense. But it's more important, in my opinion, that we give people the confidence that like, hey, you can learn stuff. You can become better. You can become so good that you have confidence to build your own damn authentication. And I will help you get along there. I'll make the tools for you. I'll put out the information. I'll give you the pep talk. I'll do all the things. But like, let's try to be a community where we're like, we're trying to get better here. We're not accepting, again, there's a broad spectrum and not everyone wants to be a professional software developer. And there are people who make software that just like, hey, I just cobbled some shit together and that's great and that's fine. But for the people who are like, hey, I'm on a path here to become a professional software developer, sky's the limit. And there's no speed limits here. You can absolutely learn everything.
On the topic of going fishing with you, are there any plans of restarting the Writing Software Well series on YouTube?
Yes. And do you know what? I should really do authentication as the first episode in the next season, because that series was exactly actually that. Taking a bunch of topics, feel intimidating or weird or perhaps a controversial, or at least just laying it out there. I'm not telling you that you have to agree with me after watching it, but I detected it. It was actually all born out of someone saying that like callbacks in Active Record is just like this hideous anti-pattern that like anyone who uses callbacks in Active Records are like they're dumb or incompetent. And I'm like, shut the fuck up. First of all, that's just my personal reaction. Now I said it out loud. But and then the positive reaction is, let me show you how we use it. And then you might go like, I still don't like it. I still think it's dumb. But at least you see it used as it was intended. And then you might go like, do you know what? Oh, actually, maybe I could use some callbacks here and there. Maybe that is actually a reasonable pattern that people could perhaps disagree upon. But you don't go like, well, anyone who uses callbacks in Active Record are either incompetent or stupid. Here's a way to show it. And I think concerns is another one of those that falls squarely into that polarizing pond where someone goes, you're splitting it up and you're making God objects and you're making all these other things. And it's just like, okay, well, let me just show you. Again, you can decide if you don't like it or not. That's totally fine. But we're not debating these kind of just like, why would anyone do this? This is just so stupid. Like, come on. I really think like, I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years. If I'm still doing it, I would have stopped, right? We just talked about a bunch of things where I stopped doing it. Webpacker. All right, we stopped. Like that was not a good path. There was a better path. You think we've not looked at other approaches? You think I've not done about a trillion AB on the before and afters? Like, okay, let's try to not use the callbacks. Oh, okay. Let's try to use the callbacks. The callbacks are better. Let's try to use the concerns. Let's try to split the concerns out to individual objects. Let's try to do compositions with this. Concerns are better. Again, doesn't mean that like this is the final answer to everything. Just that like the things that have been in Rails for a long time are usually there because they've survived, that they're used. If they're not, they get yanked. They get kicked. Kick plenty of things out of Rails that like just like, this is not a good way. Cache sweeping is a good example. Oh, we used to have a cache sweeper that you could hook up with these callbacks and so forth. And it's like, there was a better way to do cache separation, which is by having digest keys, where like the key contains its own expiration. It's much better than doing manual sweeping of caches. And then we're just like, hey, here's a better pattern that's just unequivocally better. We're going to use that going forward and we're going to kick out the old approach. Active resource was another one I had. It's like, oh, Active Resource in some ways was like the communication bridge for microservices before we started calling microservices. And like along the way, we just realized, no, actually, that's not good. Don't try to pretend that services across a network bridge is a local object, but that quacks like the same duck because it doesn't. In fact, you should make remote services feel alien inside your code. It should be ugly even. I was even thinking sometimes when we do, it's almost like we do a snake case, like let's do camel case, just it looks really weird and foreign in it. So you're not lulled into believing that like this is actually just an object running on your own machine behind here. Oh no, this is a service call. And there's this world of hurt that enters once you're doing method calls across a network, failure states and latencies and all these other things. And what's funny with that one was that it came to that conclusion of the active resource, actually not a good way of doing it. that happened years ahead of the whole microservices thing. So by the time microservices happened, I was like, yeah, we fucking tried it. It totally sucks. I'm trying to warn you. It totally sucks. I did it a lot. It wasn't good. People are like, no, this is amazing. But that's another one I does feel like has swung back. So we started this conversation talking about Rails 7 and like, why is the time right? So some of the timing is right because the technology is right and has ripened right before we're there. And some of it is because sentiments are different. The pitch Rails 7 is making now would have fell on deaf ears to anyone who weren't already enmeshed in the community in 2015. Just wasn't going to happen. React and the whole spa movement had a monopoly on attention and enthusiasm at that time, and it was impossible to crack it. Now, enough people have been through it on their maybe second or third app, building with React, Redux, whatever shit, and go like, you know what? That's not how I want to end my career. So now there's a readiness to it. I feel the same way about, hey, if you had tried to launch a paid email service in like 2012, people would have been like, what the fuck are you talking about? Email gives their shit away for free. And now 2020, all of a sudden people go like, okay, it's not free. I just pay with something else than money. I pay with my attention. I pay with my privacy. I pay with my data. And like, I'd rather pay with money. So sometimes like there's just windows that open and close in society or communities. And the window for Rails 7 is open right now. That's why I'm also so excited about it. And it's like you see some of these weird things happening. I don't know if you saw the thread on Hacker News yesterday about the node, someone who making node apps and they switched to Rails and they really liked it. And like it was an entire thread full of people just saying like, oh, actually Rails is really great. And I was like, wait, is this Hacker News? I'm trying to refresh here. Like, where's the actual Hacker News comments that say, oh, Rails is total shit. If you just use this framework that was released yesterday, that's in like 0.1, like you'd totally be better off. And just none of it, right? And you're like, that reaction would not have been the same in 2015. It just wouldn't. So that's what's really interesting about the moment is both that we're ready, that the framework is ready, the technology is ready, the vision is ready, but also there's the doors open.
Continuing the Rails 7 thread a little bit, we've talked a lot about the front end aspects of it. We often joke that we're basically like a JavaScript podcast now. I'm curious, some of the things in Rails 7, maybe like, you know, encrypted attributes, things like that have been added that you're excited about that maybe aren't front end related.
Yeah, the encrypted attributes is a great example. So that was born straight out of Hey as well. So much of this was born out of Hey, which is one of the reasons I really like making new stuff like that is because it's just there's a wealth of extractions waiting to happen. And this was one of those extractions that were happening because we were setting a different bar. One of the reasons we didn't do a Gmail competitor in 2012 was, it was funny, I was on a podcast with Jason Calcanis in literally 2012. And he asked me, oh, so you've been building this Basecamp thing and that's pretty cool, but when are you going to try something really ambitious like taking on Gmail? And I was just laughing like, yeah, I don't want that kind of headache. I don't feel like I was ready for that kind of headache. Doing email is a level of criticality that's, there's not a lot of things in tech that has higher criticality than email in terms of security. It's really the skeleton key to your whole digital identity. And I was like, don't feel ready for that in 2012. After like 20 years of practice and existence as a company, we were finally like, okay, I think we're ready. And one of the things we wanted to just step above was this, it was funny, it actually came from my wife. When we were early on in development of Hey, she was like, oh, this is cool. Could I use it? I was like, yeah, I wanted to use it. And then she was like, could your employees read my email? And I was like, I mean, they wouldn't. And then I was like, yeah, that's a shitty answer. And I understood that like, it's the same answer Gmail has, it's the same answer Outlook has. Can someone who works at Google on the Gmail product go read your email? Yes. Yes, they can. That's the nature of hosted services that's not end-to-end encrypted. And email is, it's just not. And I just went like, this is a shitty answer. I want to have a good answer. And part of coming to that answer needed to be so multifaceted. It needed to be technology, it needed to be policy, it needed to be systems, and it needed to be teams. So the technology in some regards was almost the easy part. I mean, it wasn't, but this idea that like the database at work, as it's doing its thing, is encrypted. Like if someone gets access to the MySQL database that runs Hey, they're going to see a lot of gobbledygook and foreign keys. Gobbledygook and foreign keys. That's what's in there. And they can't do anything with it because they don't have the decryption keys. So that in itself felt like a major step forward because everyone has been encrypting their backups, yes, But if someone got access to the database or had access to the database because they were working for your company and they were doing maintenance on it or they were doing something else with it, they could see the data. They can see the data. And 99% of apps out there, they can see the data if they're working on the database. And we were like, that's not good enough. We want that the ops team are able to service the database without inadvertently getting exposed to someone's emails. So that was the at work part. And the other part was we built up all these systems for console access. This is the 1984 series of gems that Jorge, who also did the encryption work, have been working on, where you essentially, you funnel all access into the Rails app in production if you have debugging issues, where it's not easy to get access to the underlying data. And it's coupled with a reporting system where you have to put in intents, like, hey, I'm accessing this data for this reason. And if you then go like, I actually do need to decrypt the data because otherwise I can't solve this problem for this customer, you're locking that as a separate event. And then we have red and blue teams, more or less, right? Like you have someone who's not that person reviewing the logs of what happened. And then we do bi-weekly reports. So bi-weekly report comes out and like, hey, 18 accesses of the console were done. We reviewed them for purpose. They were all in line with policies and so on. So after we did all the work, the technical work, the policy work, the follow-up work, I could tell my wife, no. A, they can't see your data in normal course of business. And if they explicitly try to access your data, they will get caught and they will get fired or sued or worse. That's a level of security and data protection in depth, multiple layers that I feel really proud of. And that was one of the things that being able to put some of those things into Rails, having encryption being said, it was a difficult project. We spent a long time getting the encryption right. And we had the whole system reviewed by two separate security firms that came in and looked at it and like how we're doing key management and all the other stuff. And that's exactly the kind of conceptual compression that I'm like, to be able to like, just go like, yeah, I can use encryption. I don't get it. Like I can't write whatever. I can barely coherently talk about it, right? I go, okay, private keys and public keys. And okay, that's the level I'm with that. But then we can expose that in such a way that the more applications could do at work encryption in Basecamp or in Rails, that's awesome. So yeah, that's one of the sort of big thing. I mean, the other word I'd called that didn't happen at Basecamp was site work. That was just such a monumental step forward on something that had all these little paper cuts for like since the beginning, that you could get into these states where like the auto loading of constants just weren't happening, right? And then have that work happen at just such a high level and so in depth and such a big transition. Like you go from this old system that's creaky and has paper cuts, but you largely know where the paper cuts are. And then you switch over and like all sorts of things could go wrong. But that we shipped site work as the default in Rails and deprecated the old style was thumbs up.
Yeah, I was thinking it when you were talking earlier, like the supplying the low level tools, like the encryption. When Jason asked about authentication, one of the things that just got merged into Rails 7.1 is the user authenticate by method. So you can have it automatically prevent timing attacks built in. So you, as the person who's building authentication from scratch, don't have to worry about all of those little attack vectors. And I think that's it's a great thing that we've seen now encryption in there. And, you know, a lot of people ask about how do I build a HIPAA compliant application. And now you're providing low level ways of like, if you want to keep track of what's going on with your data and all of that, then here's tools to do that. And it's great to see that being extracted out and made available to everybody. Because Rails has always been an entrepreneurial framework. I felt like there was always an emphasis on how do we help one or two people go build a business. And that is such a cool thing, but this is taking it to even more levels, I think, which is great.
It's a great example of sometimes it's easier to do the high level stuff. Like essentially like, let me take this part of my app that does this thing and put it in there. And then you get into the component nightmare where quite quickly it's more work to configure the thing than it is to actually build it from scratch. Versus if you do the diligent work of picking apart, what are actually the fundamentally shared elements here, then putting them in one at a time. And then like you have the blocks and they could be put together in separate ways. And that's where I hope we will eventually end up with device where like we've taken all the things, the bits that people lack the confidence to do themselves, and we've incorporated them into the framework in a package as easy to use as HashSecure password. And then they feel like, okay, I could do it because the pieces are big enough. I don't understand all the encryption. I don't understand all the setup, but I can use it and I put it together in a way that I don't feel like, holy shit, I'm leaving gaping holes in my security here.
Yeah. Along with this, like you were saying, 2015 is very different than 2021. There's been a lot of like, oh, we'll move from, you know, Rails to React, and then no code has been a big thing. And it's like, now your entire business is at the will of whatever that company is willing to integrate with. And that's a strange place to be. And I feel like there's sort of the, it's not maybe the best name for it, but Rails is in a way providing you as much low code kind of approach where you can duct tape all these things together. You don't need to know how the timing attacks actually work now, or the encryption. You can trust that it's been thought about and approached well, and you still have control over how the heck you want your app to work and your business, which is awesome.
Yeah, I think that part is just crucial. It's funny, no code back in the 90s when I was starting to read about sort of computer science, and so it was called fourth generation or 4GL or something like fourth generation languages. And like, you've just seen like every 10 years, there's a drive. Like, no, you don't need programmers anymore. And you see like, oh, come on, this is not going to pan out. And it never does. And it hasn't to some extent, right? Like Excel is a wonderful no code environment that has allowed lots of businesses to build quote unquote applications. Well, actually, let's remove the quotes, to build applications of a certain kind within that. And that's great. But there's just too many times where you need to do more, where you run up against those things. And that's the thing with low code, where I'm so keen that Rails tries this very difficult dance of being very easy to get started with. And then there's a path all the way, as it now explicitly says on the homepage, from Hello World to IPO. That you can literally go from like, I kind of sort of don't really understand this, to like, I'm Shopify worth $200 billion on the stock exchange. You don't have to jump off. That's the problem with a lot of no code stuff. It's like, okay, you get started. Hey, it's good, it's good, it's good. And boom, the wall is just there and it's immutable and you're never going to get past it. Because it's just like, that's the limit of what this will do. Rails should try to approximate the no code ease of getting going as much as possible and then provide the path the whole way. No walls. And this is why I'm also so spirited about learning being a key value, and that like, you don't stop. You don't just go like, oh, I don't know. You just don't know right now, but you're on the fucking path. Come along. Might take a while, might take years, but you can absolutely become an expert at this. And your expertness will take you all the way from Hello World to IPO. It'll take you all the way from like, yeah, just one user, you're doing it in development, to what was it, like 400 petabytes or however much data Shopify was pushing through on Black Friday, right? They're using the same stuff. And this is the other thing that I'm really actually keen about how Rails works today, was that Shopify was running the release candidate of Rails 7 before Basecamp. I was like, one of those things where I saw that was like, Raphael, how far along are you? Oh, yeah, we've been running RC2 for 2 weeks. I'm like, damn it, they're ahead. How is that possible? I haven't even upgraded to Basecamp yet. And I was just like, having that level of broader shoulders, both with Shopify and GitHub in particular, to take those two companies that have been so intimately involved with Rails core and so forth, be at the forefront. Like, that was just not true in like 12 or 14 or something. I remember GitHub in particular was on Rails 2.3 when Rails, I don't know, 4 or 5 were out, right? Like, they were just stuck in the past. And Eileen actually did a huge amount of that work to get them up to date. And now they're running them close to the edge. And we're getting closer to the sense that both GitHub and Shopify are running vanilla Rails. There's a real sense of kind of just like, okay, I can feel good about it. This is one of those things. So the joke, right? Well, not even the joke, the persistent thing, but does it scale? Right? Like, that's been literally since 2003, people have been saying like, oh, but does it scale? You can explain to someone in intellectual, logical term why that question doesn't even make sense. What are you talking about, not scale? Like, this is a web server, you put them next to each other. The thing that stops scaling first is the database or the data layer and all these other things, right? And I've been going hoarse trying to tell people that. Or you can just buy like, just look at Shopify. And then they shut up, right? Because there's no argument after that. That's a piece of reality that is indisputable. You just like, you can't argue with that. or at least then you have to change your argument. Oh, I didn't mean, but does it scale? I meant like, does it scale at the same price that I want? Blah, 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 blah. And then the whole thing falls apart, right? So there's a real benefit for Rails that we have these Mastodon services that are just extremely well-known and huge and valuable and so forth in the community. And not only that they're there, but that they're highly engaged. And I think that's the other thing that makes me super bullish on Rails 7. Talking to the Shopify team in particular, their newfound interest in Hotwire, the newfound interest in, well, not newfound interest, but accelerated interest in Hotwire and other Rails vanilla techniques, so that we can credibly say that like the biggest Rails apps in the world, they run the same fucking code you do.
It's funny to see the development community go after React so hard, where it's like, oh, we know React scales, but they never thought about it the other way around. Does React unscale down to one or two people? And it didn't, not the same way. And the Rails direction is the right direction to actually approach. Does it scale? If you even need to worry about that. Yes. And I also wanted to mention, like, it has been interesting to see, you know, I remember hearing about PJAX that GitHub was doing and then seeing, oh, it just turns out that's like the way we do it in Rails. And those things being tried in companies that were going bigger and pushing boundaries. And then like, cool, we'll just take those ideas, pull them back in, refine them. Now we have TurboLinks. Keep refining that. You've fixed JavaScript wrappers and things like that with Stimulus. And then Hotwire is the evolution of that. And it's really cool to see basically like, yeah, if you want to go build GitHub, you can use all the tools. Because guess what? They were all refined from building GitHub. So there you go.
That's the magic of extraction. This is not a speculative framework. I don't work on Rails all the time. It's a whole nother discussion about open source and people work on it all the time. Blah, 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 blah. But Rails is a framework built off extractions, not speculation. That all the major features and all the things that go into it, they get there because they were used in the wild and validated. Not like, oh, I think this might work. No, no, no. So it's retrospective in that way. It's always lacking to some degree because before it goes into Rails, it has to be used in the wild. And this is why, for example, Hotwire becoming a default well over a year after it was first released. And that was multiple years after all the pieces were sort of used and honed in other apps. And that was even before sort of some of the philosophical underpinnings like PJAX, for example. There's a direct line from the PJAX setup and approach to Hotwire today. And I think it just gives it a solidity that is special and not as widely distributed. There's a lot of speculative code in the wild or example-driven code where you're like, all right, let's make an example and that looks really good and that works well. But like, have you run it in the wild in anger? That's always the test for me. And there's plenty of ideas that fail along the way. I have ideas all the time where I go like, oh, wow, this will make this so, so much simpler. And then it looks great on paper and I try to do it in basement. I can't fucking find a single piece of code that's better after I write it like that. That's always my test. But like, you know what? Get a fixed idea in my head, go find a piece of code that matches and then write it in the other one. Like the number of ideas that are just on the cutting board from that process is legion. And that's good. Like we should have a constrained way, like a sieve to like, not everything goes in.
I know we've been recording for a while. I had one question I thought of when we first started recording I wanted to ask you. So you talked about like along the way with Rails, there's been decisions that people are like, oh no, like this is terrible. And they've worked out just fine. I want to maybe ask you what your favorite of those decisions was. One of the decisions in Rails that people are like, oh, this is terrible that you were kind of proud of.
REST is right up there. I think this was 2006. Doubling down on like controllers should have 7 actions at most, and that's it. The conformity of that approach really shaped my way of writing Rails and still does. And I feel like it's another one of those things that has real depth to it. Like the longer I program with it, the more in tune I get with this architectural style. So it's just that like resources just spring out naturally from things that aren't just nouns, but also interactions. So I think that one is a great one. I think the fact that Rails stuck to its gun of not retreating into the back end is huge too. I mean, the front end has seen the most churn of any area of the framework since we included prototype back in 2005 or 2006. And people will often look at that and go like, see, they got it wrong. Where I go like, What, do you want to stay in 2005? You want to still write prototype? What do you mean? The environment changed. So if you don't change with the environment, you're just going to go extinct. Yet at the same time, we did not let that curb our ambition. Most things that happened out of that were like people retreated. I'll just make this one piece. That's my little framework over here. And you figure out how to put it together. I don't know how you're going to put it together. You pick the other 5, 10, 50 pieces that have to go together for you to actually build something real. And we went like, no. Rails is going to be a framework that is used to build a whole application. And it should have all the pieces in the box. If you need to run out and buy batteries, then right? And we've sort of like, we've been dipping up and down against that line, but the commitment to stick to it and not retreat and not just go like, Rails is just going to be an API server. No. I mean, part of that refusal came from the fact that like, I personally never got convinced that the JavaScript should be the full answer on the front end. If I had been convinced of that, it's possible that Rails would have retreated to the point where it's just like, yeah, you do your own front end and we're not going to have any opinions of any kind in that regard. So sticking with that over the long term is a big part of it. REST was another big part of it. Kicking some things out, like active resource. Knowing early on, hey, we tried microservices. They're not great. I don't want to push anyone towards microservices if they can avoid them. As an architectural style, and then as an architectural solution rather than an organizational solution. As an organizational solution, I still think it's a valid pattern. When you have hundreds of developers, yeah, at some point it gets difficult. Although there are refutations of this all the time. I mean, Shopify's monolith is monolithic. That. I think Toby tweeted out this Rails stats at some point. It's like 1.5 million lines of Ruby code and like just like thousands of models. And so I'm like, wow, I would have thought much earlier than that, that you had to go some, I mean, not microservices. I think that's the other thing. In the olden days, we called it services-oriented architecture. AWS is a good example, right? Like you wouldn't have all of AWS in one thing and you needed separate teams. And that was where SOA came from back in the day, or at least was popularized from. And then also just sticking to the gun that like, you know what? Having opinions is good. It's good for a framework. Again, very controversial still. Plenty of people like, how dare you tell anyone else how to build something? Everything is just morally relativistic. And like, it's all postmodern. And it's just like how you see things and like, everything is as good as everything else. And I understand where that comes from. And believe me, I understand the never that like pushing into the controversial area of like saying like, no, I think this approach is better than that approach is dangerous business, but it's dangerous because it's valuable too. And I think we don't do anyone a service when they show up in this industry like, hello, I'm new here. What should I use? Yeah, I guess whatever you feel like, just like try it all. And in 15 years, when you've done that, then you'll know what to do. It's okay to have some answers. Like we should have a multitude of answers. Not like there's just one answer. But like for the answers that Rails have decided to go with, like go with them proud. This is what it is. It's not all of it. And that's okay.
Now that Hotwire has shipped in Rails 7, are you done? Like what's next? I'm sure people are going to be curious about like, where do we go from here?
Do you know what's funny? I thought Rails 1.0, I was done. Like literally with 1.0, I'm like, yeah, you know what? That's it. We've done it. Build a web framework. It's done. Like just, it's done. Here I am 20 years later. It wasn't done. There was more. And I think that's the fascinating thing about conceptual compression. You compress one aspect of the framework, of the difficulty of building modern web frameworks, and suddenly another thing just pops out and like, why have I never noticed that before? Well, because you were busy getting your foot snagged on this one nail. Now this slightly smaller nail, but still one that's popping out, suddenly burst into your consciousness that there's always more. There's always more parts. When you make some things easier, it highlights that there are other parts of the framework that are still too difficult or that we don't solve enough of the problem, that there are new shared issues. For example, WebSockets is a great example. 2005, no such thing as WebSockets. Not a thing that exists. New things pop up. So Rails has to react to the environment it lives in, and its environment is constantly changing. HTTP2, great example. HTTP2 was the thing that paved the way for import maps and us giving up on JavaScript bundlers as default because it enabled new things that were not possible in 12. And I'm sure that there's something that's going to ship soon that has the same aspects of it. And we're going to grow our level of ambition and the sort of large tent that we're in. I mean, you just go to GitHub Rails. see the daily commits and you just go like, it's astounding that there can be that much activity on a framework that's 20 years old. Like, how could there still be more stuff to fix or improve or make better or document or and there just is. And like, in some ways I'm like happy because I was like, what the hell would we all do if we were done? Part of the satisfaction here is that we're not done, that attainment is not happiness. That so you ship Rails 7 and it feels great. And I'm still slightly high on the experiments because there's just such a satisfaction in shipping, especially something major that really sets a new tone and whatever. But like a week from now, that'll just be a faint memory. And I'd be like, all right, what's the next thing we can work on? I think that's the other reason I'm excited about Basecamp's current trajectory, that like 2014, we said like, hey, we had all these different apps and we just like, we're going to double down. We're just going to be Basecamp. And then for 7 years, we were just Basecamp and plenty of stuff spilled out of that. But then we built, hey, I mean, the number of extractions and influences on Rails that come straight out of hey are legion, literally all the way to Rails 6.0, like 6.0 and 6.1 and 7. So much stuff extracted from hey that I wouldn't have had the opportunity to do that if we were quote unquote, just working on Basecamp. And now that the company has a sort of more ambitious take on where it wants to go and how many things we want to try at the same time. And could we make more different kinds of apps, more in the traditional style of where in, I think Basecamp launched in 2004, then Pack maybe launched in 5, then we launched Campfire in 6, then we launched Hi-Rise in 7. We launched an app a year. And holy shit, did that drive just so much energy and stuff into the framework? Because every time you tackle a new domain, you tickle the borders of what it needs to solve. We're doing email. Oh, how do we receive email in Rails in whatever, 5.2? It's clutched on to the side of Action Mailer and kind of shitty. Well, that's clearly not good enough. Boom, Action Mailbox. Essentially giving you all the low-level tools such that you could build an email service very easily with the same tooling that we have for hey. I'm excited. Like, what would happen if we try to do something else in other domains like that? In which ways will I be exposed to problems I haven't seen before? And I will want to come up with generic solutions that are fit for framework inclusion.
I have like a dumb de facto junior question. How do you choose between action and active when you're naming these resources?
It's funny. I saw someone just tweet the other day that like, what was it? They thought all the action frameworks were shit and the active ones were good, or maybe the other way around. But the dividing line is, does it touch the front end or is it back end? Is it part of the HTML? Is it part of the front end email that goes out, stuff that are rendered? Or is it purely sort of in the dungeon underneath? That like, there's almost like a dividing line here, like above ground and underground. And active is underground. It's active record, it's active support, and all these things that are like in the domain model that the user would be none the wiser. And it doesn't really talk to them. And then action is all the things that take the underground and put it to the user. It's action pack and it's action mailer and so forth. It's not exactly always clear because there are things that dip under and over, but that was just what it is. And the funny thing is it came by accident. I think it came because active record gave itself because the pattern was already called active record. And then I wanted something that sounded like it had a relation, but it wasn't just active. The other thing, if you call everything active, that felt a little... So it was action pack. In actually, it wasn't even called action pack. Yeah, it was called Action Pack. So Action Pack in the first version of Rails, like, oh, we have active and action. And then you're just like, all right, now we'll name every framework that.
I've been wondering that for so long. Thank you.
Well, I think that's probably it, right? You guys got any more questions?
No, not today. I appreciate you taking the time to sit down and talk with us about it. And thank you to you and everyone on the core team, everyone who's written PRs and commits to Rails 7. It's a very like exciting thing. So thank you to everyone involved. I'm excited to build some stuff.
Yeah, let me echo that. I mean, I'm just looking here now at releases. For the 7.0 release, there were more than 500 code contributors. I mean, that's just amazing. We released Rails 6.1 just a year ago. That's the other thing. It feels like it's 10 years ago. We did Rails 6 and now here we are. And over 500 people have code in it. And we just passed 6,000 code contributors since we started tracking. Which is amazing. And it just makes me so thrilled. I mean, I do Rails, whether I was the only one working on it, but it's just so much fun, more fun to do it together with a bunch of people who come together under the same broad tent and go like, hey, let's push this forward together. And then we can continue to do that after almost 20 years. It's just remarkable. There's not a whole lot of things like that. There's a few things here, like there's Linux kernel and there's other grand big things, and there are also programming languages, but like in this realm we play in, the churn rate is high. So for Rails not just to still be around, but to be this alive, wow. It's just, it's an absolute treat. And same to not just code contributors, but to the work you guys do, the work that people are doing, documenting it, writing tutorials, doing videos, doing advocacy, doing all these other things. There's such a broad band of people it takes to keep a community vibrant and alive that we should just be incredibly grateful that there's that many people who've decided like this is where they want to spend their time. You could spend your time in so many different things. There's endless numbers of communities and languages and frameworks and tools and whatever. And that many people have decided, you know what? I'm going to spend it with Ruby on Rails. Incredible. So thanks to everyone. Super happy with the Rails 7 release. Can't wait to see what people build with it. Can't wait to, in fact, can't wait to see like 10 years from now who goes IPO because they started something on a Rails 7 app today because they saw the examiner. They were like, you know what? I'll just try. Because that's the other thing, right? You look at all these mastodons we have now, Shopify and GitHub and whatever. Those seeds were planted a long time ago. That's what it takes. It takes 10 years until you see really the fruits of all of it. I can't wait to see what people built. And yeah, that's great.
I love that. Yeah. Yeah. There's just so much, you know, that's going on right now that people are excited about. I don't see anybody making memes about the --skip turbo links, you know, and yes, all of that. People are really excited about this and like embracing it. And that's a good thing because there was definitely that period of time where there wasn't that sort of embracement. And it feels like a nice revival to excitement around everything that's going on. And it's also interesting just to look at it and see like the ecosystem that changes the most is the browsers and the JavaScript, and HTML and HTTP haven't really changed that much. Those things are very solid and well-oiled and a nicely organized machine. And we're starting to see the same thing happen in JavaScript, which is really cool. So it is a good time to be in the Rails community. I think it's only going to get better. So
100%.
We're all excited.